Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Risk assets continued their grind higher last week. This as investors digested a new round of economic data. President Trump and President Xi of China also spoke, setting up negotiations between the two countries this week. Perhaps the biggest story last week was the break between President Trump and Elon Musk. So a lot going on, Jason, as usual. Joining us once again here in studio, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, resuming our in-studio conversations the first time in a few weeks. So great to be back at the table with you.
It's good to be back.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it, Jason, perhaps beginning with the economic data. In particular, last week, we did receive a lot of labor market data, including the May jobs report on Friday. So what was your takeaway from the data we received last week on the labor front?
Well, it's early June, which means we start getting all the May data beginning last week from ISM, manufacturing services. But I think the real focus was on the labor market data overall, which included the payrolls report on Friday for me, but also JOLTS data, which goes back to April, the weekly jobless claims. I think the overall story to take away from the labor market is that it's still relatively decent. It's moderating very gradually. But certainly, I think the fears that investors have now, given the issue of tariffs potentially being a drag on the economy, is a bit of a step down change or falling off a cliff in the worst case scenario for the labor market. That was not evident at all with the payrolls coming in a little bit above expectations. So kind of solid number in that regards. But the overall sort of story from the labor report was certainly more mixed. The prior 2 months were revised down, combined about 90,000, sort of offsetting some of the beat on the upside. The household survey that determines the unemployment rate was a little bit softer. And while the unemployment rate on an unrounded basis, it was still at 4.2%. If you start going down to the second decimal place, third decimal place, it went from roughly 4.16 to about 4.24. So again, still rounded 4.2, but almost a point higher or tenth of a point higher. Initial jobless claims have been ticking a little bit higher, but still at a very low level overall. So again, softening labor market, consistent sort of with a slowing economy, but not clearly kind of an inflection point where we're seeing real kind of slowdown. The ISM data was a little bit weaker. Like the ISM services, went back below 50, which is viewed as kind of contraction territory, the first time in a while. Yet if you look at the overall tracking estimates for Q2, it's still near 4%, like a 3.8%. Certainly more data to come that will change that. It also speaks to the fact that the GDP data in particular is going to be very distorted in Q1 and Q2 because of tariff front running before Liberation Day on April 2nd and the payback. And so there's a lot of kind of distortion. I think if you just try to look through all that and say, what's the underlying trend? It is towards some kind of moderation of growth, at least at this point in time. We're not yet seeing a really obvious impact from the tariffs in the data. That could start to change at least this week, because the key economic data points this week are the inflation data that will come out over CPI and PPI. That could be the first signs of tariff being passed along to the consumer. It still may take another month or two before it's evident, but that could be the first sign. And that's also in the context of the inflation data has been relatively well behaved for the past few months, so kind of giving me assurance that the underlying disinflation trend is in track, absent to the impact of tariffs. And then the question, all this leads into is what does this mean perhaps for the Fed? The Fed has been basically saying we're in a relatively good position to be able to kind of wait and see, and the labor market data, suggesting overall, yes, some moderation, but not really significant cracking. It allows the Fed to kind of reinforce that view, which is why the market pricing for a June cut, which is in 9 days from when we're talking now, recording, is almost 0%. And even for July, it's only 1.6. So it's not until you get into the fall that is it really kind of the market fully pricing in one full cut, and it's down to 1.8 cuts for the year.
So in terms of how investors have been responding as of late, I did mention that it was another positive week last week for risk assets, aside from the S&P 500 going up again. What else, Jason, was notable about market performance last week? We did have a strong ending on Friday.
So the S&P was up about 1.5% for the week. But beneath the surface, what was really kind of notable was the leaders were small caps. The Russell 2000 was up 3.2%. cyclically oriented sectors kind of led the way. Defensive sectors, by and large, were flat to down. So if you kind of take that difference, kind of cyclicals outperformed defenses by nearly 5 percentage points. So all that with, you know, the cyclicals, the small caps, it was a pro-risk on, sort of pro-cyclical, you know, higher beta, you know, story, which has not been the case as far as the markets recovered from their low back in early April. You know, high kind of higher quality, by and large, last week's the first signs of really kind of broadening out where you're seeing, you know, some kind of performance catch up. Perhaps as investors also look and think, well, how much higher can the S&P go in the near term? What areas of the market can kind of catch up? And so at least the price action last week is consistent with that. Then you look at the VIX vol index, it's down to about 16.7 or 16.8. It's the lowest level it's been since, you know, early March. Mm-hmm. So before the tariff situation really started to escalate. At the same time, if you look at interest rates, the rates kind of went up across the curve from anywhere from like 12 to 14 basis points for the 2-year to about 10, 11 basis points for the 10-year. The 30-year, which has been in focus because it's been rising more quickly, was only up, you know, 4 basis points. That really reflects the fact that, you know, the data overall and the labor market data overall suggests, again, the Fed doesn't need to cut. That's why you saw the curve sort of move in its direction, you know, overall. So a relatively kind of positive story for kind of, you know, the markets in general, excuse me, consistent with just a generally, you know, better view of, you know, how long growth could sort of hold up, and further suggesting that the left downside tail risks for the economy are relatively contained at this point in time.
So, Jason, I do want to get your thoughts, and this heated up a bit as the week went on last week. We did see the feud between President Trump and Elon Musk. Based from that, do you see any implications for Trump 2.0 economic policies, whether that be Doge, the One Big Beautiful Bill, or perhaps something else?
Well, there was certainly an interesting, you know, developments, particularly on the Thursday when the tweets were going back and forth. Great water cooler conversation to speculate what happened and why. I can imagine in D.C. it's a kind of running rampant. But as investors, you know, it might be fun to kind of have a, you know, debate and discuss, but ultimately kind of ask, like, what does this mean for economic policy? Mm-hmm. Does this really have any impact on what the Trump administration plans to do? And I'd say the short answer is, you know, probably not much, or maybe even, you know, very, very little. By the time that happened, it was already clear that Elon was stepping back from the administration. You know, for perhaps a variety of reasons, but his political influence has certainly been, you know, kind of waning.
There was an announcement a week prior, I think, in the Oval Office that he's stepping away.
The week prior, but if you want to go back earlier in the spring, there were these special elections in Florida, but also Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Elon had put a lot of money into Wisconsin. The Republican candidate didn't do well. So you can think of it as Elon's sort of political juice perhaps was
wearing off,
not that strong. And so if that's the case, you think about where he could have some influence. You know, Doge certainly got some high, you know, kind of, that was his, you know, high profile. It was already evident, you know, a few weeks ago, a month ago, maybe, you know, more than that, that a lot of big headlines of cuts, but the actual reality of what was happening was, in terms of dollars being cut, was much less. It had already also appeared that Congress was, through the budgeting process, trying to kind of take back some of that authority to, you know, how much, you know, these different departments and government agencies would actually spend. Elon did criticize the One Big Beautiful Bill as being, you know, increasing the deficit. It's not doing enough to cut. But this goes back to the point of like the political influence. If you're a Republican, you know, deciding what to do, it's much more significant if President Trump tweets at you versus Elon Musk tweets at you. So I think that, again, he can complain about the size of it, but I think it's going to be relatively insignificant to the direction of travel beyond what already Republicans, I think, were kind of concerned with in terms of, you know, some of the futures. On tariffs and trade, I think that was never something that Elon was overly influential on. I think what sort of matters more there is the fact that there is some self-imposed deadlines of these 90-day reprieves that are now only about a month away. Negotiations, as we speak, in London between the U.S. and Chinese officials. So again, Elon wouldn't be, you know, overly significant there. Mm-hmm. I think what is a little bit more perhaps interesting or relevant to think about is almost take a step back from the specific policies to think more along the ideology or framework of Trump 2.0 or Trumponomics, you know, as I call it. At the start of the year, I wrote a piece I titled, like, you know, MAGA v. Doge.
Yep, which we spoke about. Yep.
And the idea is like, well, what is the sort of the economic philosophy of the Trump administration? And subsequently kind of asking also like, what is exactly is Trumponomics? Because it is certainly a not traditional Republican policies. It is a heterodox mix of different sort of policies. And if we think of MAGA as you know, a pro-America, America First, you know, trying to support workers who've been left behind over the past 20 or 30 years. You know, obviously anti-free trade, even in some sense anti, you know, kind of, you know, the tech sector. I would, in simple terms, if you want to kind of distill it down, say this is meant to be more labor supportive overall, as a perhaps as an ideology. Mm-hmm. Whereas DOGE, like, literally was going into kind of cut government spending, cut government waste, trying to make the delivery of services to the public more efficient, mm-hmm. putting it into the hands of the private sector where appropriate. And therefore, I would kind of classify it as like smaller government, private sector, more pro-capital to do it. So in simple terms, MAGA's mm-hmm. pro-labor, you know, DOGE is kind of more pro-capital. At the time, I would have conjectured that ultimately the policies will lean more capital-friendly. Now, if we fast forward to, you know, just about a week ago, the S&P 500 at that point in time was still not even in positive territory for the year. So you could say whatever the set of policies that have been done are not necessarily friendly to capital at that point in time. But they were definitely unfriendly to capital back in early April after mm-hmm. Liberation Day. And since then, we've had this kind of significant bounce back.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, if you kind of assess the shift in the policies overall from where they were, it is looks like it's going back towards, you know, the pendulum swinging more towards at least being not anti-capital, but more friendly, you know, to, you know, on capital. We know President Trump historically has followed the stock market, uses the S&P 500 as a gauge for success. As back in March and April, he'd be asked, like, are you following the stock market or not? Or it's down today as a result of tariffs. He'd be sort of dismissive. But I think it's clear that the shift over time is reflecting of concerns about the overall state of financial markets. And you know, equity is certainly not exclusive, you know, to that. So I say all this in the sense of, can we glean anything from what, you know, Elon's leaving, you know, means? I'd say ultimately, if he represented more of a DOGE capital-friendly environment, I think the administration already seems to be shifting in that direction, focusing on trying to get the one big beautiful bill passed, which would have tax cuts, tax incentives for investment. There'll be a bigger push towards kind of deregulation. And on trade and tariffs, which would say it's the most perhaps potentially harmful for the economy, at least in the near term, it seems like as much as they'll try and escalate things, they've kind of narrowed in on a sort of a sweet spot, a level of tariffs overall that they feel like could raise revenue to cut, you know, enough to help offset, you know, tax cuts elsewhere, to incentivize production back in the U.S., to help perhaps potentially kind of reduce trade deficits. So I think if the markets sort of feel like what they're doing right now, that's where it's going to be. Mm-hmm. I think that is a level that, from an investor perspective, that is, so that risk reduces, and then you can start to look more towards pro-growth policies, pro-capital policies going forward. So I think that's the way, to me, when I do a bit of a five-month-later status check of that right. kind of idea, it felt like, certainly 2 months ago, this is not necessarily capital-friendly. Today, it feels definitely more investor-friendly.
It's very interesting, these considerations, especially when you think about the evolution of DOGE and how that has influenced markets in recent weeks and months. If we end with asset allocation, Jason, just given everything that's going on at the moment and a lot coming up ahead of us, you mentioned the key inflation data this week, the upcoming Fed meeting. What are your key recommendations at this time when it comes to positioning?
Well, kind of picking up this idea of ultimately, you know, we think the policies will be kind of capital friendly. That, again, sort of suggests that, to me, that we are in still a kind of an equity bull market. You know, it's come back, you know, very strongly. So if you look at year-to-date, it doesn't feel like it's a bull market. If you think about where we were in April, it feels like, well, now could this be resuming a bull market? I think it's more of, you know, of the latter. And that the policies ultimately will be, you know, favorable. There'll be speed bumps along the way. You know, trade negotiations may not be entirely smooth. Passing of the one big beautiful bill may hit some speed bumps along the way, but the direction of travel, that still feels, you know, relatively safe. I'd say that's on a, again, bigger picture, kind of 12-month view. In the near term, the markets, I think, are pricing relatively good news. If we were to get jobs, you know, print or inflation print even this week, where inflation's running hot, mm-hmm. that will spook, I think, the markets. And certainly if you get that combined with some weak labor market data or consumer spending data later in the summer, that's going to reinforce the idea of, well, is a stagflation scenario, you know, still possible. So I think that's, you know, given how big the moves are, I think that the near term is, you know, going to be pops, you know, maybe grind a little bit higher, but also very vulnerable to some, you know, data point that's disappointing. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the weakness we would get in maybe the economy is going to be in the second of this year. At some point, the markets will start to focus on better 2026 in terms of more fiscal support, directionally deregulation, better earnings outlook. So again, I think thinking in that sort of bull market context. So phasing into equities as pullbacks, you know, but realize that, you know, this is mm-hmm. sort of the dynamic, you know, we're sitting in. Pivoting from equities to fixed income, You know, the rates have backed up again, like the 10 years back to around 4.5%. You know, as it gets higher, that starts to become a level where it looks a little more interesting to add duration. But at the moment, still kind of comfortable. You're not taking a lot of interest rate risk, staying at the front of the curve. You stay in higher quality because, similar to equities, you know, credit spreads have tightened up. Things have gotten richer again. So don't need to take a lot of, you know, credit risk. And through all this choppiness, gold continues to seem to kind of, you know, chop a little bit higher in fits and starts. So again, sort of an effective diversifier, you know, overall. So that's something else that we like at this point in time.
Well, Jason, as always, a very helpful touch base to begin the trading week. Thank you for joining us. As is often the case in these times, headlines are very fluid. So thank you for providing your thoughts on what we've been seeing, how it's been impacting the markets, and providing some guidance when it comes to positioning.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.